Good morning, everybody. The sermon text this morning is Ecclesiastes chapter 2. If you are using one of the hardback black Bibles that are in the pews, that's on page 553. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word, for your guidance, for your comfort. We ask that you would open our hearts and minds this morning, that we might be guided and comforted by what you have to say. Amen. Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychologist who survived the concentration camps during the Holocaust. And while he was in the camps as a psychologist, he made something of a study of the psychology of people under extreme duress. He wanted to understand what led some people to endure in the horror of Auschwitz and others to give in. And Frankl's conclusion was that the key to surviving life at its worst was to find meaning. He wrote up his findings in a book called Man's Search for Meaning, in which he wrote down his observations that it wasn't the physically strongest or healthiest, it wasn't the people who most managed to curry favor with the guards, it was the people who found some meaning for continuing to live. He based the remaining decades of his practice on, in order to live, we need meaning as much as we need water. We need something that makes life worth living. Now, Frankl took a sort of any port in a storm approach to meaning. As long as you could find a meaning, it didn't really matter what it was. Just grab onto it and hold it tight enough, and you would be okay. Our text today is very much the preacher, the author of Ecclesiastes, examining that claim and saying, actually, there's no such thing as a stormproof port. If you try to find meaning on your own to make your life worth living, it won't work. So I'm going to read our text through, and then we're going to kind of examine it twice this morning. One, we'll look at the substance of the text, what the preacher is saying here. And then two, we're going to look at the purpose of the text. Why is he saying it? Which will be a question that might become apparent to you once I read the substance of the text. So Ecclesiastes 2, verses 1 through 11. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during their few days of life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So the substance of the text is the preacher saying, you cannot manufacture meaning. You cannot make your life worth living. Whatever you think might make your life worth living, I tried it. I've been to that port. It didn't protect me from the storms. And he hammers this. Anything you might think of, again and again and again, right? He says of laughter, laughter's a good thing, but laughter will not make your life worth living. Okay? We know this. I have this distinct, wonderful memory of laughter. When I was 11 years old, my mom took my two younger brothers and I on a road trip from North Carolina to her college roommate in Springfield, Illinois. It's about a 17-hour drive. Right? And we did pretty well for 15 hours. And then the last vestiges of civility burned away. And we were past, my brothers and I, sniping at each other, and we were just elbowing each other in the face. And then my mom brought out her secret weapon. She had purchased a set of Bill Cosby tapes. And she put them in, the actual tapes, this is how long ago this is, into this cassette player, and the last 2 hours of that road trip went from being elbows and cutting comments and are we there yet to side-shaking, continuous laughter that we all still remember to this day. It was good. And it did not make our lives worth living. More than that, if you're familiar with the end of his life story, it did not make Bill Cosby's life worth living. Laughter is good, but it does not give meaning to your life. It does not make your life worth living. The preacher says this as one who has experienced it, and then he says, it's not just laughter. He says, wine also won't make your life worth living. I assume anyone in the room who has ever cared for an alcoholic knows this, right? That wine cannot make your life worth living. To be clear, wine is good. Jesus made good wine. It's not a bad thing. It just won't make your life worth living. Nor us moderns, nor will anything else that serves the same function as wine. Right? Wine is excellent for mitigating the lows of life and manufacturing a facsimile of the highs of life. Right? You can sort of generate a fleeting, nice experience, and you can, for a time, push away a terrible experience. Right? Wine does this to our brains. Right? And it doesn't make our life worth living. Same thing with the versions of wine that have to be given to you through a prescription pad. They may manufacture the highs and mitigate the lows, but they don't make your life worth living. Same thing for the versions of wine that have to be mediated through a digital screen. They may manufacture the highs and mitigate the lows, but they don't make your life worth living. Those are some of the easier ones. Right. Now, the preacher turns to something a little more universal and subtle. He says achievement can't make your life worth living. And he spends longer on this one than on any other. I think what he's doing here is trying to communicate there is no version of achievement that can make your life worth living. You don't need to spend your existence switching types of achievement. You don't need to go from academic achievement to career achievement to family achievement to retirement and leisure achievement, testing each version of it. None of it works. This is what he says in verses 4 to 6 to drive the point home kind of relentlessly. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards. I made myself gardens and parks and planted to them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. All kinds of things. What the preacher is evoking here is I tried to recreate Eden. The garden that was well watered and contained every kind of fruit tree. Life on earth as it was meant to be. I chose the best kind of achievement, chased it with unlimited resources and ingenuity. I built it, and it did not make my life worth living. Students, there is no grade you can receive, no degree you can earn, no job you can be offered that will make your life worth living. You could cure a disease, single-handedly build a sustainable development, and your life would not become worth living. There's no kind of achievement that can do that for you. It is not possible. Laughter can't make your life worth living. Wine can't. Achievement can't. Next, verse 7, possessions can't make your life worth living. I bought male and female slaves, and I had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. When the Ecclesiastes is written down, most of the original audience, we ought remember, is living hand to mouth. They have no spare possessions. So we can understand how tempting this might be. You know what would be nice? Is to have enough food for today and tomorrow. What if we possessed enough that we could pay other people to do the most miserable work and just focus on the work that we feel called to? That sounds pretty good. But in our age, the age of storage units and estate sales, we really ought to know better. As generation after generation goes through life spending money so that they can avoid the hardship of getting rid of unneeded possessions, and then in death inflicts those piles of possessions on their poor children, we really ought to know that there is no number or type or quality of possessions that can make our lives worth living. Now, I'm not going to make you turn and confess how much money you have spent on storage units in your life. Possessions can't make your life worth living. Right? Neither can beauty. Beauty also can't make your life worth living. This is what the preacher is getting at in verse 8. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. The silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces, in the context of Solomon's life, that's referring to gathering the exotic, the wonderful, and the beautiful from all over the known world. Right? It is the ancient version of the modern travel industrial complex. The beauty of all the variety of creation, and the beauty of music, and the beauty of sex. These things cannot make our lives worth living. I have hiked to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and I have lounged on the beaches of Maui, and it was good, but it did not make my life worth living. I have sat in these pews with tears in my eyes, listening to some of you sing the chorus of Is He Worthy? And I have jumped up and down in a football stadium, listening to Bono sing Sunday, Bloody Sunday. And I still haven't found what I'm looking for. I have, like I assume all of you, no inclination to publicly discuss my personal experience of the other kind of beauty that Solomon mentions in verse 8. Let us simply say that the Creator who invented procreation knows how to give good gifts to his children, and that those gifts do not make life worth living. There is no form of beauty, no new and wonderful experience that can make your life worth living. The last thing that the preacher experiments with and wants us to know will not make our life worth living is winning. Winning will not make your life worth living. So I became great, verse 9, I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. It's not just that I was great, it's that I was a little bit greater than everybody else. And it didn't make my life worth living. I was really counting on my friend Taylor to be here, because I knew he would be able to answer this question, but somebody else. Who is the greatest quarterback of all time? You're too old, Mark. Football kept happening after 1990. Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback of all time because he won the most. And he was giving an interview in which he was asked about it. And his response, this is halfway through his career, he said, "Why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I reached my goal, my dream, and still I think there's got to be more than this. This can't be all it's cracked up to be." And the interviewer asked him, "What's the answer? What is the more than this?" And all Brady could say is, "I wish I knew. I wish I knew." No amount of winning will make your life worth living. Now, you might say, of course, no amount of winning in football makes your life worth living. Football is arbitrary, an inherently meaningless game. And that is a valid point, but irrelevant, because it is equally true that no amount of winning as a parent can make your life worth living. No amount of winning as a pastor can make your life worth living. No amount of winning as a nation can make our lives worth living. These things will not work. The preacher tries them all and draws the conclusion, all was vanity and a striving after the wind. Tried all these good things, and none of them could hold the weight of my existence. None could make my life worth living. When I was a kid, I remember looking up at the cumulus clouds. I grew up in North Carolina, not in Oregon. They have white, puffy clouds in other parts of the world. And I remember looking at them and thinking they were just like cosmic pillows, that it would be so cool to be able to get up on top of one of those clouds and just lay back in God's mattress and take a nap. Right. Of course, now I know that if I had managed to get up into all of those clouds, I would have been anything but comfortable, freezing and damp on my way to death on the ground. Right? Because no cloud, however big, however lovely, can hold even my body. And yet, the preacher is pointing out, we spend so much of our life falling through one cloud thinking, oh, I just picked the wrong one. I should have gone for that other cloud that would hold me up, that would make my life worth living. And the preacher wants to be clear, there is no such thing as a cloud that can hold you up. You cannot make your life worth living. There's no form of pleasure or accomplishment that can do it. That's the substance of the text. That's what he wants to communicate. Why? What's the purpose of saying all of that? Is it just sort of an ode to cynicism? It's all pointless anyway. Is it maybe, you can tell that I'm an oldest brother because I thought of this, is it the perverse pleasure of popping a younger person's bubble, of explaining to your little brother that the magic of Santa and his reindeer is actually just mom's credit card and Amazon Prime? What is he doing here? Sorry, Deacon, I didn't mean to do it. The substance of what the preacher is saying is so explicit, so clear, it's hard to miss, it's painful. His purpose in saying it is much more subtle. What he's actually doing is warning us against wasting our lives trying to manufacture meaning. Wasting our lives trying to make them worth living. When what we're actually meant to do is receive lives that were worth living in the first place. This is not clear. It is subtle. But I want to show it to you through what's abundantly present in the text, and then what's glaringly absent. Yes, Rachel got it, or at least part of it. One of the things that's glaringly absent is God. But first, what's abundantly present in the text is first-person singular pronouns. In the English translation of these 11 verses, there are 41 occurrences of I, me, and myself. There are actually more than that in Hebrew. And in Hebrew, all three of those sound the same. So it reads like the heartbeat of the text. And if you were just listening to the sounds of what the preacher wrote, it would have this cadence of like, I, me, my, myself, self, myself, myself, myself. Vanity. Death. That's the actual rhythm of what's going on here. The preacher is, it's an entirely individual pursuit that he's engaged in. Can I make my life meaningful? Can I make my life worth living for myself? I don't know how he did this 3,000 years in advance, but it's like he wrote the chorus of our culture. Right? This is what we are not just permitted to do now, but commanded to do. This is a quote. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, of the mystery of human life. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, of the mystery of human life. That's not from a college freshman philosophy paper. That's from a Supreme Court decision. Planned Parenthood versus Casey, Justice Anthony Kennedy, said this not as a speculation, but as something so certainly true that you could base legal doctrine that affected people's lives on it, as a given thing. That to be human is to be making your own life worth living. Defining your own meaning, not just for you, but for the entire universe. This quest to manufacture meaning out of nothing for ourselves, by ourselves. This is, for us, it's like salt in the ocean. It's not one thing that takes up one part, it permeates everything. And even if we don't deliberately open our mouths and swallow, it is leaching the water out of us, drawing life out through our pores. This quest to do it ourselves, to make our own lives worth living. And the preacher is trying to free us from this futile quest, to convey that it is utterly vain, hopeless, to engage in this in any form for any period of time. It's utterly vain because it pushes out of our existence what actually gives life meaning. So if I, me, and myself are the abundantly present part of this text, the glaringly absent is any form of second person, of you, yours, or yourself. As Rachel correctly observed, God is not present anywhere in the text. But it is equally true that when other human beings show up in the text, they are not people. They are not you, they are it. Right? I bought for myself male and female slaves and had slaves born in my house. I acquired singers, men and women, and concubines who are the delight of the sons of men. Right? When other humans appear in this quest, they are not persons made in the image of God worthy of love. They are tools that may or may not be useful. Totally absent from this text are other persons, are other lovers and beloveds. And those are what are meant to give life meaning. Human and divine. A word quickly to the Christians in the room. One way to read the book of Ecclesiastes is as purely for the church to use against the world. Like an expose on life without God, outside of the church, and how futile and vain it is. And that's true. But we need to remember that the preacher is a leader of God's people writing to God's people about his heart and their hearts, about his life and their lives. He takes for granted that it is perfectly possible to be in church, to read the Bible, to do all of the right religious things, and yet be living a life that is glaringly absent of other persons, of other lovers and beloveds, that is just a religious version of the I'm going to make meaning for myself. This is for us too. What we all need to hear, whether we would call ourselves Christian or not, is that, yes, we can't make life worth living. One of the most important reasons we can't make life worth living is because it already is that. It was given to us as life worth living. Your quest to manufacture meaning in your life is like a quest to make the sun hot. Not only do you not have the means to change the sun's temperature, it doesn't need your help being hot. It is already that. In fact, things are supposed to flow the other way. The sun doesn't receive heat from you. You receive heat from the sun. Life doesn't receive meaning from you. You receive meaning from life. This week, Wednesday afternoon, we had a naming ceremony for Samuel and Annie's new baby Faith. I'd never been a part of a naming ceremony before. It was this simple, lovely experience. I also didn't know that in the Iani's culture, a baby doesn't just get mom and dad compromising over two names. All of the most important people in Faith's life got to name her. They each gave her a name that they will each call her, and each of those names has a meaning, tells her who she is. So she came into life receiving meaning from those who love her, from those who most care about her. So she, before she was capable of doing anything, accomplishing anything, manufacturing any kind of meaning, she got told who she was. And I'm going to read and hopefully not too badly mispronounce the names and their meanings because it was so beautiful. Right? She is named Faith, strong belief in God. She is named Nifemi, God has love for me. She was named Eri Ifeoluwa, the proof of God's love. She was named Helena, shining light. Anuolua, the grace of God. Iriolua, the goodness of God. Angelica, messenger from God. Moyosoneolua, I rejoice in God's favor. Before she could engage in any kind of a quest, Faith's life is saturated with meaning that she does not earn but receives from those who love her. Of course, Faith is now in her 11th day of life, 12th day of life, something like that. Like, she's not capable of humor. She doesn't even know how to smile yet. Right? She doesn't intake wine. She is not achieving much of anything. She possesses nothing. She can't even focus her eyes, much less absorb beauty. And I don't know what sort of a contest she could possibly win. None of which matters, because it's not on her to make her life worth living. She gets to receive a life worth living from those who love her. This is the way it is meant to be. Now, I don't know about you. I was deeply moved by that ceremony and all it signified. I also find myself thinking, yeah, but life is not a naming ceremony. The symbolism and the richness of we who love you are going to tell you who you are and the meaning of your life is so on point. and so broken in the real world. Yeah, I mean, like, theoretically, you could start off from square one, get so obsessed with making your life worth living that you push love away and refuse to receive it. But, like, it usually works the other way around, does it not? Usually we're born into a world where love is tainted by using or is absent and replaced by using. And in that vacuum, we try to come up with some meaning, something that makes our lives worth living. Like, there are certainly extreme cases of that, but it doesn't have to be extreme. I think of my own kids, who I spend some time genuinely loving and some time using to prove that I can win at a contest of verbal cleverness between me and them. Right? And something in their hearts needs to fill in the gap. Either get good enough to win that contest, or change the rules, or go in a different direction to manufacture some meaning in life. Right? We live in a world that needs naming ceremonies. We don't live in a world that's completely defined by them. Which is why Jesus entered the world. Came into a world in which no one was perfectly loved, in which everyone was at least a little bit used and refused to use everyone, and specifically went after the people whose lives had been marked by lovelessness, sought them out, and brought love to them. Went to the demon-possessed man who lived in a graveyard because he couldn't get any closer than that to the rest of us. Went to the bleeding woman whom no one would touch, not even her own family, and put his hands on her. Went to prostitutes and tax collectors. Said, I'm here to love you. In my Father's house, there are many rooms. If it were not so, would I not have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? You're right. You haven't been well loved. You're right. You have been used. You're right. There's a hole in your heart, a haunting meaninglessness that you cannot fill in and you cannot paper over. And I'm here to fill it in until it overflows with my love. So however you came here today, longtime Christian, never heard of Jesus before. Jesus is the one who sees that hole. He doesn't wag his finger at you or turn away, but holds out his arms and says, come and finally be loved. You can give up trying to make your life worth living, because I find your life worth dying for. And that is enough. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the gift of life. Thank you for the gift of love. Thank you that you do not leave us scrambling to make our lives worth living, but sent your Son who came and gave his life for us. Father, teach us to receive your gifts. The love and the life that you have gone to such lengths to provide for us. Teach us to receive and to be full. Amen.